In a world where uncertainty reigns supreme, where shadows of chaos dance at every turn, one truth emerges unyielding. Preparation is not a luxury, but a lifeline. Behold the Wellness Company, a beacon of readiness amidst the tempestuous seas of fate. Envision a sanctuary of tranquility, where the tumult of unforeseen medical crises finds no purchase. The Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit stands as a bastion of assurance, a fortress of resilience against the unseen foes of health. Within its sacred confines lie the tools of salvation. Ivermectin, to ward off the insidious whispers of disease. Emergency antibiotics, to quell the raging storms of infection. Antivirals, to vanquish the relentless tides of contagion, and more. The Wellness Company Medical Emergency Kit is not merely a collection of supplies, it is the embodiment of preparedness itself. Crafted by the hands of esteemed healers led by luminaries such as Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, and Dr. Drew Pinsky, this kit stands as the pinnacle of safety, the zenith of prevention. These truth-seeking doctors have forged a testament to vigilance, a testament to the unwavering pursuit of well-being. Embrace the certainty that comes from being armed against adversity. Embrace the Wellness Company, for in its embrace lies the promise of resilience, the promise of a brighter tomorrow amidst the chaos of today. Don't wait for the next crisis to strike. Visit twc.health/strangeplanet and use promo code STRANGEPLANET for an exclusive 10% discount. Prepare today and rest easy tomorrow. There's a very common sense reason gold is pushing to all-time highs right now. Actually, there are several reasons. The cost of goods continues to rise despite interest rate controls by the Fed. Since Jan 21, the cost of living is up 17.9%. The national debt continues to skyrocket, now above $34 trillion, causing many to worry when the house of cards will come crashing down. A presidential election year that'll have massive implications on the future of this country. All of this adds up to instability and uncertainty, and that's why so many Americans are turning to Birch Gold Group. Have you diversified your savings yet? Secure a portion of them with gold from Birch Gold. Text STRANGE to 989898 and get your free info kit. You'll learn how to convert an existing IRA or 401k into a tax-sheltered IRA in gold, and it doesn't cost you a penny out of pocket. With an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau and tens of thousands of happy customers, you can count on Birch Gold, too. Just text STRANGE to 989898 to claim your free info kit and to protect your savings from uncertainty today.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
On this episode, a celebration of TV character, reporter, monster hunter, Carl Kolchak from The Night Stalker.
The anticipation was running sky high. And then you watched it, and it had this kind of vampire cinema verite style. The lead character was a cynical, hard-nosed reporter, almost a throwback to the front page newspaper comedy era. And he didn't want to believe in vampires, and he didn't believe in vampires, and he doesn't accept it until he has to.
This podcast is brought to you by Paranormal Contractors, a division of Crime and Trauma Scene Cleaners. If you have unwanted paranormal activity in your home or business, it's time to bring in the professionals. Call them at 1-866-724-0800 or email them at paranormalcontractors@gmail.com. Check out their YouTube channel, Paranormal Contractors, for things that go bump in the night.
Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett. Pursuing the truth wherever it leads. Exposing evil and corruption and the secret machinations of powerful elites. Revealing the high strangeness beneath the surface of our supposed reality. Coming to you from his studio beneath the stairs. Here's Richard Serrett.
Thank you. Welcome to your Monday. Now, how many of you remember that theme song? Of course, that's from The Night Stalker. And although it only ran for one season on ABC back in the mid-1970s, it remains a cult classic. It featured a fictional Chicago Wire Service reporter by the name of Carl Kolchak, played by Darren McGavin, who investigated mysterious crimes with unlikely causes, particularly those that law enforcement authorities would not follow up. These often involved the supernatural or science fiction, including fantastic creatures. The series was preceded by two television movies, The Night Stalker in 1972 and The Night Strangler in 1973. Here, to celebrate this groundbreaking television show and the character, Carl Kolchak, is Mark DeWidziak. Mark is a journalism graduate of George Washington University, and he's worked as a theater, film, and television critic since 1979. He's been the television critic for The Plain Dealer in Cleveland since 1999. In addition to writing two nonfiction books about the Carl Kolchak character, Night Stalking, a 20th anniversary Kolchak companion, and The Night Stalker Companion, DeWidziak has edited three collections of works by Richard Matheson, all published by Gauntlet Press: Richard Matheson's Kolchak Scripts, Bloodlines, Richard Matheson's Dracula, I Am Legend, and Other Vampire Stories, and Richard Matheson's Censored and Unproduced, I Am Legend Screenplay. And he is the creative consultant to Moonstone's comic book series, Kolchak, The Night Stalker. His work in the horror field includes a 1994 novel, Grave Secrets, a play, The Telltale Play, short stories, comic book scripts, and the nonfiction book, The Bedside Bathtub and Armchair Companion to Dracula. Mark DeWidziak, welcome to Conspiracy Unlimited. How are you?
Great and good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Likewise. We both have an affinity for vampires. Let me just briefly tell you my entree into the vampiric world. In 1967, my parents took my four siblings and I to the drive-in movies, and the trailer for an upcoming feature was The Queen of Blood, starring John Saxon, Dennis Hopper, Basil Rathbone, Forrest J. Ackerman, and an Eastern European actress by the name of Florence Marley, who played the alien queen, and she was a vampire. And just that three-minute trailer, it stuck with me for most of my adult life, in fact. The second film that impacted me was the 1971 ABC movie The Night Stalker with Darren McGavin, and I believe Claude Akins was in that, and Simon Oakland. I was maybe 7 years old. I was home alone with my brother, who was 7, 8 years older than me, and we sat up and watched it. And then at the end of the movie, he said, "Well, it's time for you to go up to bed." There was no way I was getting off that couch and going up the stairs. So I was really traumatized at an early age by vampires, but I've since learned to love vampire movies. How about for you? When did it all begin?
My introduction to vampires was also at the age of 7, and it was a bit friendlier and more positive than yours, because it would have been a few more years before you. But at the age of 7, I happened to see a movie called Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Oh, yes.
Which was on, where I grew up in New York. It was on WPIX, Channel 11 in New York. And I was there for the Abbott and Costello half of that. I grew up on, that's what they gave us when we were growing up. They gave us the comedy of our parents and in some cases our grandparents. They gave us Abbott and Costello and Laurel and Hardy and the Three Stooges and the Little Rascals. So I was there for the Abbott and Costello half. I had never seen a horror film. I didn't know what a horror film was. And, but in that movie was for the second and last time playing Count Dracula on film was Bela Lugosi. Mm. And Lugosi's performance just mesmerized me. It turned me into a horror fan and a vampire fan in particular. So I saw that at the age of 7. I was 15 when Night Stalker aired in January 1972. I was 15 years old. I was by then a horror fan of 7, 8 years. Anything that was vampiric that had come my way in between, I had seen, whether it was a Hammer film with Christopher Lee or Dark Shadows with the Barnabas Collins character. I was there.
And what are your memories of the Night Stalker movie, which came out in the early 70s?
So the commercial started in October. What a lot of people tend to forget about Night Stalker was that one of the reasons for its great success was the incredible advertising campaign ABC put on. And you had to have been there because they started right around the end of October, around Halloween, and it was relentless. The commercials were so good. They made you think, there's a vampire running loose in Las Vegas. I've got to see this thing. And everybody felt that way. The whole nation felt that way. By the time it aired in January, on a cold Tuesday night, everybody was with the anticipation was running sky high. And then you watched it, and it had this kind of vampire cinema verite style to
yes.
it. Because
yes.
the lead character was a cynical, hard-nosed reporter, almost a throwback to the front page newspaper comedy era. And he didn't want to believe in vampires, and he didn't believe in vampires, and he doesn't accept it until he has to. So it made it all the more believable, which, by the way, is the same device that Stoker uses in Dracula in 1897. He takes a verite style by having it be epistles, diary entries, and newspaper clippings.
Right, right.
Read like a record
right.
of what was that. When you read it, it reads like, oh, this is something like it's actually happening. So Night Stalker had an enormous impact on me, not only because the storytelling was so good, but also because I don't think it's understating the case to say I became a reporter because of Carl Kolchak. I started my work towards my journalism career as a freshman at George Washington University in September of 1974. September 1974. What else happened in September 1974? Well, that Friday, the 13th, was when the series Kolchak the Night Stalker premiered.
That's right. Carl was working for INS, and you were working for Knight Ridder.
Well, not yet. I was starting as a freshman at that night. I was working towards that, but I was surrounded. This was just weeks after Nixon had resigned the presidency. And George Washington University is located just a few blocks away from the White House. So you have to realize that journalism departments, colleges and universities were doing land office business at this point. Everybody wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein.
Right, right.
You got Pulitzer Prizes for this. You took down presidents. And I didn't. I wanted to be Carl Kolchak. I couldn't, I've told this tale till it's gone stale, but it's true that I remember thinking at the time, if they ever make a movie of all the President's Men, because the book was out and everybody was arguing, who's Deep Throat? Who do you think Deep Throat is? And I knew if they made a movie of all the President's Men, they would get somebody who looked like Robert Redford or Dustin Hoffman to play Woodward and Bernstein. And nobody was confusing me with Woodward and Bernstein. I was a descendant of immigrants with a European surname, dressed badly, what kind of role model could I possibly have?
Hmm.
Carl Kolchak was perfect. He got there through determination, hard work. He was not necessarily the smartest guy in the room. He got there through determination, and that's how most journalists get where they're going to get.
He had chutzpah, and then
I cannot tell you how many reporters have told me over the years they became reporters because Carl Kolchak was the most realistic depiction of a reporter they'd ever seen. And I think I tell this story in the Night Stalker Companion that when I worked at the Akron Beacon Journal, and I was the TV critic there, I was crossing the newsroom once, and I saw this shouting match going on over at the copy desk. And it was one of our reporters, a big fellow, just a bear of a guy. And he was yelling at this editor, just giving this editor down the road. And as I got closer, I was making out the words. And the words that he was shouting at this editor was, this is a newspaper. We're supposed to print the news, not suppress it. And it was perfect. The delivery was perfect. I got right up behind this guy and I said, you're doing Kolchak.
Exactly.
And he wheeled around. I thought I was going to get a punch in the nose because this guy was just a huge guy. And he had the biggest grin on his face that you've ever seen, like an actor who had just gotten a rave review. And he looked at me and he said, you're right. You're the first person who's ever gotten that. That's my favorite speech. In any newspaper movie, it so defines what a reporter is. And I have had reporter after reporter tell me, and journalist after journalist tell me, that how influential this character was. So in addition to being incredibly important on supernatural storytelling forever after this, because the world kind of changes after Night Stalker, it's also had a big impact on my world, my immediate world of journalism.
So how did you become a chronicler of Carl Kolchak and the Night Stalker?
I had no intention of becoming Carl's biographer, shall we say. That was not in the cards for me. I loved Night Stalker. I loved the two movies. I loved the series. Anytime that Darren McGavin was in that seersucker suit and that pork pie hat, I was there. But this is going to be a little bit of a long answer to your question, but I'll try to make it as short as possible.
I'm eating it all up. It's all
in order to understand it, to answer your question. See, in 1979, I moved to Tennessee to become the arts editor of a small newspaper in East Tennessee. And I was working on my first book there. It was a history of the Barter Theater, which is this fantastic theater, which was started in the depths of the Depression. It is also the most haunted theater in America, but that's a subject for another show at another time. And I was researching this book, and I was coming down the pike on writing this book, and I knew what my second book was going to be. My second book was going to be the history of The Twilight Zone, my favorite TV series of all time. And I never really stopped to think the practical question, which has probably already occurred to you, which is, gee, maybe East Tennessee is not the best place to research a book on The Twilight Zone. Maybe he could pick a better place to research. But I did enough interviews over the course of a couple of years to delude myself and to fool myself into thinking I was actually going to write this book. And Donna Douglas came to town, for instance. She was shooting a commercial for Mobile Homes, and she was dressed up as Ellie Mae Clampett. And I ran down to the set, and I asked her questions about working with Rod Serling and in Eye of the Beholder. And then a couple of the people who were at the Barter Theater had been in Twilight Zone episodes. Claude Akins was one, who's also a Night Stalker.
Yes.
There are those connections. And Fritz Weaver was another. So I was doing interviews here or there. And then what happened, I had that experience that many writers have in their lifetime. I walked into a bookstore around 1981, and there it was, Mark Scott Sacree's The Twilight Zone Companion. And I couldn't be disappointed. I couldn't be angry. Because Mark had done a really, really first-rate job, much better than I ever could have done with that book. It's a landmark book, not only about The Twilight Zone, but about how TV shows are made in general. It was one of the first books to really do a deep, deep dive in talking to the stars, the writers, the producers. So being a practical fellow, I immediately changed my goals to another favorite series, which was Columbo.
Ah, yes.
Okay, so I set to work on, and my goal was to do as good a book on Columbo as Mark had done on The Twilight Zone. And that book was published in 1989 as The Columbo File. And I like how it came out. And this is how, if you think you're in charge of your life, if you think you're making the decisions, you have to get to a vantage point where you can look back, and it's a big enough and a good enough vantage point that you realize you were pushed in certain places and you weren't really calling the shots like you think you were. I once interviewed the actor Brian Dennehy, and Brian Dennehy had this marvelous career where he went from movies like Cocoon to great miniseries on television to Broadway doing Long Day's Journey into Night.
The Architect.
Yeah, and it was wonderful. He had this great career, and I asked him about what his career plan had been that he could have pulled that off. And he started laughing, and I said, "What are you laughing about?" And he said, "I'm an actor. Asking an actor what his plan is like asking a man falling down a flight of stairs what his plan is." And I thought, what a great answer. And that's kind of the way you look back and you realize you've really been falling down a flight of stairs. I knew what my next book after the Columbo, this is I knew right after the Barter book that my next book was going to be on the Twilight Zone, and it wasn't. I knew that my next book after the Columbo file was going to be a book on Dashiell Hammett, the mystery writer.
Right.
Why not? I was with a mystery press. I had just done an acclaimed book on a great mystery character. This was going to be the chart of my career, but fate said no. Oh, no, 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 no. And what happened was the press that I had the handshake deal to do the Hammett book, their owners got rid of their nonfiction line. They became strictly a fiction press. And my book was left an orphan. And it was at that point that the phone rang and a publisher of a small publishing house in New York called me and said, listen, I'm a big fan of your Night Stalker, of your Columbo book. Have you ever thought about doing the same type of book on the Night Stalker? And I said, well, yeah, I love that series. But I didn't know that there was a publisher crazy enough to do that book. And he said, well, I'm crazy enough to do the book. And I said, okay, well, hold on a second. Before you go making plans, let me see if I can get the cooperation of four key people. If I'll get back to you very soon, but if I can get Dan Curtis, Darren McGavin, Richard Matheson, and Jeff Rice to say yes to this, I'll do it. And I did not know Jeff Rice or Darren McGavin at that point. I did know Dan a little bit.
The creator of Dark Shadows.
And I did know Richard a little bit. So I got all four of them to say yes right away. And so I said, yeah, I'll do the book. And that was published in 1991 as Night Stalking. Now, what I did not realize at the time, and you can't realize it, is that Night Stalking pushed me back to where I wanted to be in the first place, where that kid who was 7 years old and watching Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein, and then was 15 years old and watching The Night Stalker, where that kid wanted to go, I was being pushed. And that Night Stalking opened up the door to do the first original Kolchak novel in 20 years, which was Grave Secrets, which was published in 94, because a publisher got the rights to Kolchak, asked Jeff to write a new novel. Jeff said he wasn't interested in doing that at that point, but he'd let me do it, which was a tremendous leap of faith because I hadn't written a novel before. And then there was the revised edition of Night Stalking, the Night Stalker Companion 97. There were three works that I edited for Richard Matheson. There was the book on Dracula, The Bedside Bathtub and Armchair Companion to Dracula. If you stand back and look at it now, you realized I was being pushed back towards the Twilight Zone. Because indeed, during all this time, I kept thinking I was owed a Twilight Zone book. That's silly.
That's right. That's where it all started, right?
That's silly. But it still was something I thought. And when my daughter turned 15, I started sharing the Twilight Zone with her. I kind of noticed in discussing the Twilight Zone with her that these were all life lessons and morality tales. And I thought, hey, stupid, you got a book here. My agent agreed. St. Martin's agreed. So in 2017, I got my Twilight Zone book. But it wouldn't have happened without Kolchak.
Right, right.
None of it would have happened. See, and it goes back to that moment in 1989, 1990, when if I'd gone down this road, we probably not aren't talking right now. But Kolchak rescued me twice. See, he rescued me when I was 15 years old and was looking for a role model and was looking for a profession. And then he rescued me again from going down the wrong road and saying, no, you always wanted to go here. And this way, I'll get you to the Twilight Zone. And he did.
There are a number of common denominators with the Twilight Zone and the Night Stalker. And of course, Richard Matheson is one of them. How did you, you approached Matheson first when you were going to write what later became the Night Stalker Companion. But that was, a friendship that kind of evolved, right? From there?
I knew him a little bit before that. You see, I actually knew Ray Bradbury first. I'd met Ray in when they did Something Wicked This Way Comes, the movie version. And Ray and I got very, very friendly, and we were going to do a book together. I wanted to do a book, sort of like a Hitchcock Truffaut book, a series of discussions on the film, TV, radio, audiobook, comic book, every adaptation of his work, any move into a different medium that had been done. And we would talk about it. We would talk about it at length. And we worked on this book for about 5 years. And then projects took us in different directions. Matheson sort of crossed that because they were involved in some things. They were very dear friends. Ray was a mentor to Richard and all of the group, the Southern California group of writers. So I knew Richard peripherally because of that book, and Richard had done the TV miniseries version of the Martian Chronicles. And I also had interviewed Richard for a TV movie he had written about the life of L. Frank Baum called The Dreamer of Oz, mm-hmm. which was done for NBC with John Ritter as L. Frank Baum. So I kind of knew him just a little bit, through these things. And then in 1990-91, we started talking about Night Stalker, and this is where it kind of deepened into friendship a bit. And he liked the book, and then he blurbed Grave Secrets. And then Gauntlet wanted to publish his three Night Stalker scripts, Night Stalker, Night Strangler, and the unfilmed Night Killers that he'd written with Bill Nolan. And it was through those projects that we got to be good friends. We'd see each other. When I went out there, we would meet for lunch, like at Jerry's Deli near in Calabasas, where he lived, which is one of his favorite places to go. And and we talk on the phone quite a bit. So this was where, again, Kolchak is he's the gift giver for as far as I'm concerned, because the universe gave me this.
Right.
The universe gave me this chance to get to know Richard Matheson and to work with him on three book projects. And then it's like, you can think you're pretty hot stuff. You can think you're all that. And then you open up a book, one of Richard's books, and see he's mentioned you in the dedication to the book. Well, that can pretty much send you reeling a bit, and you can realize that you can pretty much retire on that. So when I say that I have been rewarded so many times over for my association with Carl Kolchak. You know, life did not treat Carl very well, but Carl has treated me exceptionally well.
How much of the Kolchak persona was created by Darren McGavin, and how much of that was Jeff Rice or Dan Curtis or Richard Matheson?
That's a really good question. And the answer is all of it. The answer is the Kolchak character, the essence of the Kolchak character was based on two people, Jeff himself and his experience as a reporter in Las Vegas, and a friend of Jeff's, a reporter named Alan Jarlson, who worked in Vegas. And if you physically, Carl in the book is much more like the Alan Jarlson persona than he is Darren. He doesn't match up. And Tony doesn't match up to Simon Oakland either in the book.
Tony Vincenzo, the long-suffering editor.
Right. They were described differently in the book. And if you read Jeff's original book, you don't really see Darren McGavin or Simon Oakland. But the essence of their characters and the essence of their relationship is there. Carl's a smartass. Carl's a hard-driving reporter. Oh, that is all there. And the story steps, all of the story steps that led to the movie are there. Jeff wrote a book which got everybody excited. And everybody said it. Everybody, Richard Matheson said it. Dan Curtis said it. Darren McGavin said it. He said, what got you all fired up? It was Jeff's book, because it was such a great idea. A vampire loose in Las Vegas. The American town, a town which is up all night, which is on a vampire schedule. Las Vegas is a smorgasbord for a vampire. Where would you go if you were a vampire?
Right. He's preying on Las Vegas showgirls.
And this mob, and at the time it was a mob controlled town. And Jeff was metaphorically talking about a lot of things that he couldn't talk about as a journalist. So he put it all into this amazing book. That the control of the town, the corruption, all of that, which goes side by side with the vampire in that to that story.
Right. What a cast, too. You mentioned Simon Oakland and, of course, Claude Akins.
Ken Smith, Carol Lindley.
Oh, yes.
Elijah Cook Jr.
One of the great character actors.
Barry Atwater's job as Yanis Skorzeny, the vampire.
Yes, yes.
A character which was, because you have to remember that this is interesting. This is an interesting point as far as vampire, fitting this into sort of vampire lore and where it comes, is that the moment the world changes as far as vampire storytelling goes, really is Dark Shadows. 67, when they let Barnabas out of the box in 67, and he becomes a phenomenon. And then he becomes so successful that they can't kill him off because they were going to. The whole plan was that Jonathan Frid had a 3-month contract, and the 3 months was going to end with a big piece of lumber sticking out of his chest. Well, that plan went to the sides when everybody started to fall in love with the character because of the way Jonathan Frid was playing it. And so they humanized the vampire and ultimately gave the vampire something he had never had before because he had no use for it, which is a conscience. A vampire with a vampires are predators. You know, between 1897, in the publication of Dracula, and 1967, Barnabas comes out of the box. In those 70 years, there is no advance on the vampire character at all. There's little hints you see in Dracula's Daughter. There's little hints you see in movies like House of Dracula, but the vampire always goes back to being predator. That's his job description. It's a limited job description. Barnabas not only reclaims his soul and reclaims his humanity, and he questions himself. Why would a vampire question his nature? Barnabas is endlessly questioning his own nature. Do I have to live like this? Can I change? And you know, who's watching that? Anne Rice is watching that. So Anne Rice is going to take all of those questions, those Dark Shadows questions, and she's going to give them to her immortals, and they're going to run loose with it. So you have this, and that's the path which leads us to today. So you have this moment where the vampire changes. The vampire is on the road to True Blood and Vampire Diaries and Twilight.
But there was none of that with the Jano Scorenzi, Skorzeny vampire.
And that's what's interesting, is you almost get the reaction to the reaction, is that Night Stalker is almost like this moment where, because a few years after Night Stalker airs, there are two books on the bestseller list simultaneously. They come out within 6 months of each other. One is Stephen King's Salem's Lot, and the other is Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire. And it's like Stephen King is on the Night Stalker side of the equation. Saying, No. Vampires are nasty, mean creatures. They have teeth, and they use them. And Anne Rice is saying, no, vampires are reflections of us as humans and need to be humanized. So you have these two schools of thought. The interesting thing about Night Stalker is who gives us the first revolution? Who gives us Dark Shadows? Dan Curtis. Who gives us the reaction to the reaction?
Dan Curtis.
He provides his own response. And that vampire is so inhuman that poor Barry Atwater was not even allowed to talk. He could only communicate through snarls and growls and hisses. And they didn't even want him to say anything because they wanted to make him so inhuman and so animalistic. And it works really well. And your big Twilight Zone connection there is that guess who's in the same Twilight Zone episode with Claude Akins? The monsters are due on Maple Street.
Barry Atwater. Right.
So we have two Night Stalker connections and one Twilight Zone.
How about Elijah Cook Jr., who was, I think, one of the great character actors of all time? He was in the Twilight Zone, wasn't he?
I have to think, I should know that off the top of my head, but I can't think of when he's in. I'm not sure he is.
How about Carol Lindley?
Carol Lindley, I don't think was.
No.
There are a lot of people who were in both. There was a lot of crossover, like Charles Aidman, who is in plays in a police officer. It was in both. James Gregory was in a Twilight Zone, and he's in a Night Stalker episode. Keenan Wynn is in two as Joe Siska, the police sergeant in Night Stalker. He's in a world of his own, written by Richard Matheson, a Twilight Zone episode. So there are a lot. There's a lot of crossover as far as actors go.
Right.
John Fiedler, who's in Night of the Meek with Art Carney, one of the great Twilight Zone episodes, is Gordy the Ghoul.
There's
your major your crosses there. So there's a significant overlap as far as actors, and as of course there would be.
I'll be back in a flash with more of my conversation with film and television critic Mark Dawidziak as we continue to discuss Carl Kolchak and The Night Stalker. Stay with us. Think of your colon as the waste management station of your body. All of the cells and tissues in your body and your major organ of detoxification, the liver, rely upon a well-functioning colon so they can cleanse your body of toxins. In other words, a healthy colon is the secret to living a healthy life. Then how do we cleanse our colon? Well, for me, the answer is Life Change Tea and Formula 13 Teas from the folks at GetTheTea.com. These remarkable organic, non-GMO, caffeine-free herbal teas are a great way to start your day. Just 1 8-ounce glass per day provides a gentle cleanse that will leave you feeling energized, clear-minded, with an overall sense of well-being. Why not get on board and discover for yourself all the benefits of Life Change Tea and Formula 13 Teas from GetTheTea.com? And as a loyal listener of this podcast, here's a gift. Use the code UNLIMITED when making your first purchase, and that first order ships for free. Go get your Life Change Tea and Formula 13 Teas right now from GetTheTea.com.
Reality. Richard is a very strong and handsome man. Just not in our reality. Although I heard somebody passing him in the hall the other day, and it was quite a handsome man Richard is. I made that up. Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett.
Admittedly, the story you're about to read is bizarre, incredible. Those of you who wish to avoid being unsettled, who wish to avoid thinking, will label it insane. And though you, the reader, would find these facts almost impossible to substantiate, that does not change their nature. Facts they are. I know. I saw them happen.
Film and television critic and the author of The Night Stalker Companion, Mark Dawidziak, is here. There was so much anticipation for the series, and yet it only lasted the one season. And my understanding is that basically McGavin was exhausted because he was also, I think, co-producing. Was that what eventually killed it?
Yeah, he was exhausted, but he was unhappy too. The seeds of Night Stalker's destruction as a series were planted by Universal at the beginning. It went wrong right at the start. They were going to do the third movie, but Darren and Dan had a falling out at the end of Night Strangler. They had a bitter fight, and they weren't going to work with each other. And then Universal got interested in doing it as a series. So they licensed it. And they went to Darren and said, will you do this as a series? And Darren said, yes, under two conditions. One was that it wouldn't be Monster of the Week, that they would do different kinds of stories. Well, of course, it turned out to be Monster of the Week. Secondly, Darren wanted to be the executive producer. And they told him that he could be. And then they double-crossed him. They put their own producers in charge. Darren was technically not a producer of any kind on that series. It has been mistakenly put down in a lot of books that he was a producer or an executive producer on the show. Technically, he was not. He was a de facto producer, I suppose, because he was running things on the set. But meanwhile, Universal had created two armed camps. The production offices and the writer's room was one, and then Darren was running things down on the set. And so there was this incredible antagonism between Darren and the studio right from the start. The hours were long. The hours were very, very long. And they were also treated as something of the poor stepchild on the Universal lot at the time. If you look at the hierarchy of the Universal shows at the time, the top of the hierarchy was Columbo. Columbo was the prestige show. It was the show that won Emmys. It was the show with the big budgets. They did 90-minute, two-hour movies, and they had an Emmy-winning star, and everybody wanted to write for Columbo.
He was the highest-paid man in television at the time,
yeah,
I believe.
Peter Falk, yeah. There was a lot riding on it because the whole mystery wheel was hung on that raincoat.
That's right. MacLeod, so, MacMillan, yeah. MacMillan and wife.
And they could never fill the fourth wheel. They had Heck Ramsey in there and Lonergan's Rabbi and
Banachek.
No, Banachek was part of a different wheel.
Oh, that okay.
Part of the Wednesday wheel. That was the Snoop Sisters. Yeah, that was an attempt to launch a second wheel. And Banachek was a good show, too. There's a whole different story with Banachek. But anyway, to stay on point, Night Stalker was considered the bottom of the pecking order at Universal. And that's why you got some young writers who made their first sale to Night Stalker. Bob Zemeckis was one. Bob Zemeckis and his writing partner, Bob Gale, and as Zemeckis told me, they looked around the Universal lot at the time and said, well, we've got no chance to sell to Columbo. But don't aim at the highest one. If you want to make your first sale, aim at the lowest. They're looking for material. They're looking for writers. So they sold their script, which was Chopper, their 50s greaser updating of the Headless Horseman myth, and which is not a bad episode.
No, I remember
and,
that one.
And that became about because they wanted to make a sale, and they took shot. So Night Stalker had this sort of funky group of writers, and they were mostly young. And David Chase, who would go on to create The Sopranos, was the story editor. Michael Kozel, who would go on to co-create Hill Street Blues, was a writer on the show. Zemeckis was there. So you had this kind of funky group of writers, and a very good producer, a very good veteran producer named Cy Shermack, who had taken over the show after the first few episodes. And if it had been clear from the start that Cy was the producer and Darren was there as an actor and not as promised to have been the producer, it may have been a happier ship. But it wasn't, and Darren did not like the long hours. He didn't like the fact that it was Monster of the Week. He loved Kolchak. But Darren didn't like anything except the original movie. That's the thing about Darren is, if you when you sat down with him and talked Kolchak, he had nothing bad to say about the character. But as soon as you got to the second movie, Night Strangler, he kind of dismissed Night Strangler. He said, "Well, it's all very well, but it's kind of the same story all over again." And it isn't, and it has a different feel, and it's quite an entertaining movie. And then when you got to the series, Darren really didn't have much good to say about the episodes.
For me, one of the shortcomings was some really bad makeup with the monsters, the werewolf in particular. It almost felt like with the Planet of the Apes, even though the franchise was a huge success, every movie they kept cutting the budget back, and the makeup got progressively worse. For me, what really worked with the Night Stalker series was the interaction with the characters, whether it was Kolchak's rival at INS, Ron Updike, we called Uptight, Jack Greenidge, and the lady that did the crossword puzzles and the advice column. Yes, Ruth McDevitt. And of course, Simon Oakland. That interaction with those characters to me was just wonderful.
But you know why? It's because the writers were so influenced at the time with situation comedies. They structured a hour horror show like a situation comedy. They created a family, which is what you do. You either create a work family or a home family. In this case, they kind of did both because Tony is sort of the long-suffering father. Miss Emily is the loving grandmother. Ron is the uptight brother. Carl is the bad boy hero in all this. And they created almost like a sitcom family, and they wrote almost in sitcom rhythms. Because the big shows at the time that there was like the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and they were okay. this is, we're going to create this kind of sensibility with this show, and we're going to overlay, which actually didn't work too badly because comedy always was a part of Night Stalker from the first movie. That movie is a very funny movie. In addition to being a very scary movie, it's a very funny movie. It works as sort of a horror movie, as a newspaper comedy from the 1930s, a throwback. And it also works as a mystery, a classic mystery where Kolchak is the detective trying at a throwback to Darren's background as playing Mike Hammer for so many years on the Mickey Spillane series.
Right.
So, you know, it one of the reasons that movie is so had such broad appeal is it did hit on all three levels. So adding the comedy to the series actually was something which was already there in the Kolchak. He is funny. He's, you know, he's funny. There are many good comic moments in the Night Stalker. There's even more in the Night Strangler. And so you see that played up a lot more in the series. The problem with the main problem with the series was the fact that not only couldn't they get the A-level writers like Universal to work on it, but even if they had, there weren't very many experienced horror writers working at Universal or any studio at the time. They had trouble finding people to write Columbo because it was an open mystery and it was hard where you knew who the murderer was right from the start, and that's tough to write. And there were only a few writers who showed up after a big screening just to recruit writers. If they had had the same kind of screening, it would have been tough because you really experienced horror writers weren't working on Universal shows at the time. And the one episode that I think is clearly the best episode that the series had, that if the series had to hang its reputation on one episode, it would be Horror in the Heights. I think it's the one where everything comes together beautifully. The comedy, the mystery, and the horror all play at a perfect level. It's a really well done, and it's got a great idea. It's got a great monster and a fantastic idea behind it, that the monster, the demon, comes to you in the form of the person you trust the most. That will be a good idea any way you want to slice it.
This is like a Hindu demon, right?
Yes. Yeah, you know, the Rakshasa.
Yeah.
And what a great idea. And it's no mistake that idea comes from Jimmy Sangster, who had written almost all of the Hammer horror films.
Right.
So Jimmy Sangster is the only true horror writer who worked on Night Stalker.
And Phil Silvers is in that episode. Okay. I mean, you can't get any better than that.
Oh, yeah. A lot of old comedians are in there. Benny Rubin is in there, as is this great, great, wonderful episode. And I think coming in very close to second as far as the series was probably the Spanish Moss Murders. I think those are their two best episodes. And they only did 20. They only did 20 episodes. So they pulled the plug because Darren was tired, and he was tired of fighting, and he was tired of the long hours. And as Darren told it, because there was a myth that arose that Fred Silverman took over ABC, and he did not like supernatural stuff, and he canceled The Night Stalker, which is totally untrue on all counts. Not the least of which is that Night Stalker was canceled before Fred Silverman took over ABC, so it couldn't have happened. But even at that, when I asked Darren about the chronology, his response was, "Do you want to know who canceled the Night Stalker?" He said, "I canceled it."
Yeah, he didn't want to do it.
And he said, "I went to Universal and said, I don't want to do this anymore." And Universal said, "Well, we have this deal with ABC." So he went to ABC and said, "I don't want to do this anymore. Let's cancel it." And ABC said, "Well, we have this deal with Universal." And he said, "Look, you two sets of clowns get together and cancel this thing." And they did. And that probably does make a certain amount of sense because they only did get to 20 episodes. And a season order back then for Night Stalker probably started at 26 and got cut to 24 and then got cut to 22. 20 episodes, there were still two episodes probably left on what was already a cut order. And they had two scripts fairly well ready to go that would have been probably the 23rd and 24th episodes. But Darren was just, and this is another truth, which because you have to understand how TV works. TV isn't in the charity business. TV goes strictly on ratings. Back then, certainly it did. It goes much more on demographics now, but back then it went, there were only three networks. And Kolchak was always up against incredibly intense competition. For much of its existence, it was up against on NBC, Sanford and Son and Chico and the Man, which that season were the number one
show.
Yeah, I mean, it was murderous. And in a season that had like 76 shows, Night Stalker was 72.
Oh, boy.
Which means it might have gotten canceled anyway. This idea like, well, they were going to get another season. I don't know that the ABC brass would have looked at that and said 72. the notion that they would have gotten another season is speculative at best.
Right. For me, my favorite episode was really the sequel to the original movie, which in this case involved a female vampire. She was, I guess, a victim of the original Las Vegas vampire that somehow they lost track of. And of course, she comes back and makes her way to Los Angeles. And also the zombie.
Two very good episodes.
Yeah, as a child, I remember those being particularly scary.
I think the zombie gets added points because it has what is often isolated as the scariest moment in the series, which is Kolchak trying to sew the zombie's mouth shut.
Yes, in the back of the car.
In the back of the car. I mean, a lot of people just if you say, well, what is the single most scary moment in the series, that would chart very high, very high. And both those episodes are very strong episodes. And I would say if you had a vote and people voted on the top five, those would come in the top five.
Absolutely. Hey, whatever happened to the convertible Mustang that Carl Kolchak drove around in?
Yeah, it's a good question because back then, when a series shut down, studios were incredibly unsentimental. How unsentimental are we talking? Well, first off, we were talking about Kolchak's wheels, the Yellow Submarine, the Mustang. They had a show on at the same time, which we've already talked about, which was a much bigger hit and had a much more iconic car, which was Columbo's Peugeot. Columbo ran on NBC for 10 years from 68, the original movies, to 1978, when the 45th and final NBC mystery aired. Then around 1989, 1990, there was talk of rebooting Columbo, and one of the first things that you had to do is go find the Peugeot. What did they discover? They sold it. They had sold everything that wasn't nailed down because it was a series which was even a big hit like Columbo, is what I'm saying. They had gotten rid of everything, basically, because it was a dead series. When are we going to ever need it before? Who revives series? You know, we're talking about the 1970s. So they, wherever they could make a profit, they did. And they sold the Peugeot to a collector. They had to rent it back from that collector for all of the ABC mysteries that they did after. Where I'm getting to, going back to Kolchak, is can you imagine just how hard it would be to find that Mustang now and what became of it? They may have even dismantled it for parts. Who knows? It may have gone back into the they had this huge garage at the Universal lot where they had all of the cars. It's where Peter Falk found the Peugeot, in fact, for Columbo. And most of those cars were just pulled out of the garage. And they had all sorts of makes and models. So that car could have been long since junked. It could have been sold to a collector. I know of nobody who has it. Nobody has stepped forward to claim they have the Mustang. They'd be quite a piece if they did.
Or the seersucker suit, or the little Instamatic camera, or the cassette recorder.
Well, I remember the seersucker suit was Darren's idea. that's what you, before you asked about like who contributed what, and I started by saying that Jeff contributed a great deal. Richard contributed a great deal by taking the elements of Kolchak and heightening them in the script. But even Richard had Kolchak dressed in like Bermuda shorts and Hawaiian shirt and baseball cap. He had sort of an outlandish outfit for him as a reporter. And Darren read that and went, no. And Darren had this vision of what reporters wore in the summer in New York when he was an actor in New York. And they always seemed to wear very lightweight suits like Seersucker. They always had lightweight hats like that stupid little pork pie straw hat he wore. And they all wore those little string reporter ties. And he added the sneakers because he thought, well, Kolchak runs a lot. He's a man of action. So Darren came up with the costume, just like Peter came up with the costume for Columbo. And it was his wardrobe. Darren came up with Kolchak's uniform, if you will. And he also added his personality to it. So what Darren brought to it was he really defined who Karl Kolchak was. When Jeff saw it, when Richard saw it, when Dan saw it, they all realized that Darren had gotten to the essence of who Karl Kolchak was. And one of the ways he did that was by bringing a lot of himself to the character. What helped define Kolchak was that Darren was drawing on himself. Darren was a hard-nosed battler as an actor. He had a great sense of humor. He loved working with young people. There's so many really lovely stories about Darren working with young actors, where he would see a young actor who was new and uncertain and struggling, and right before they were going to shoot, he'd take them aside, he'd take the script and say, I'm having trouble with this script, can you run lines with me? You know, he didn't need to run lines. He was trying to get this young actor to feel better about themselves and to feel better about the upcoming scene. So
that's nice to hear, because he often played, you know, such curmudgeons on the screen.
Ooh,
it's
Darren
nice to know that
too.
He was
no mistake here. That Darren had that side too, and that's part of Kolchak as well. But Darren, Darren was a battler, you know, and Darren could be pretty pigheaded, you know. I mean, the chronology of this gets a little confused, and I'm not terribly sure of it completely. But when the X-Files came along in the early 90s, and Chris Carter would tell anybody who asked, and a lot of people who didn't, that the reason he invented the X-Files was because the Night Stalker had scared the piss out of him when he was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And that he wanted to do his Night Stalker, if you will. You should have some of those elements, the paranoia, the truth is out there type of stuff, the affinity for the supernatural investigation. And Darren heard that in the early years of the X-Files. And what Darren heard was not they were inspired by the Night Stalker, but they're ripping off the Night Stalker.
Uh-huh.
And he got mad. Now, he'd never seen it, you know, and people would try to tell him, no, Darren, they're not ripping you off. They're not ripping off the Night Stalker. This is a very different show.
They're paying homage.
Homage, yes, this is exactly. But Darren was having none of it. He had it in his head that they were ripping it off. And at different phases, they wanted Darren to play... They had talked about him playing Senator Matheson.
Right.
They had talked about him playing Mulder's father. And they had talked about him reprising Karl Kolchak, that they would go to ABC and work out a deal where they could use the Kolchak character. And Darren, this was during the point where Darren was saying, like, why would I want to do that? They're ripping us off.
That's too bad. That would have been wonderful.
Well, any one of those would have been wonderful.
Yeah.
Darren could have been on part of the show almost from day one, because they certainly would have wanted him there. And this was part of Darren, too. And what changed his mind, by the way, was he did an episode of Millennium by the same crew. And he had such a good time doing Millennium. And that made him realize, oh, no, they're not ripping this off. So at that point, they had come to him about playing Arthur Dales, the founder of the X-Files. And so Darren ends up in a couple of episodes playing the Arthur Dales character. So he is in the X-Files universe, but he could be there. He could have been in there. And that's sort of like saying he's Mulder's father, by making him the founder of the X-Files.
Right, right.
It's a good character for him to play. And in fact, Darren was working on, I think it was going to be the third episode with him as Arthur Dales when he suffered the stroke that ended his career.
Right, right.
You know, and then they brought in M. Emmett Walsh to play Arthur Dale's brother, also named Arthur Dales, and which they never explained, but it's the X-Files, so why explain it? But that was Darren. I mean, that was you know, Darren had he was not all one thing. That's for certain sure.
Mark, how do people get a hold of Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone, or the Night Stalker Companion, or the Kolchak Chronicles? Where can they get a hold of some of, well, this vast body of work that you've contributed to?
I always, you know, send people to, you know, I don't mind sending people to Amazon, because you're never going to do better, you know, from price-wise on Amazon. And it's certainly, you know, a good place to get the Everything I Need to Know I Learned in the Twilight Zone. The Night Stalker Companion, sadly, is out of print. It was published in 97. We're talking about an antique here. It was published in 97. So we were talking about more than 20 years ago. It was stayed in print for more than 10 years. And then, you know, it ran its course. But I don't know. I've been flirting with the idea of a 50th anniversary edition. You know, January 2022 will be 50 years. Since the original movie aired, and I certainly have collected a lot of material since then. I've certainly done, you know, talked to a lot, and there have been additions to the story since 97. I could see that. I could see that happening. If and again, people will say, "Are you going to do it?" I'll go back to what we were talking about before. I ain't in charge. you know, if you know, the right publisher would need to step forward, and the timing would need to be right, and I would have to be not working on another book. I have another book coming out in September on the Shawshank Redemption.
Oh, wonderful!
Because this is the 25th anniversary of that. So that is I did about 70 interviews with that, Frank Darabont, Morgan Freeman, Tim Robbins, and had a great time researching that. So that book's coming out in September. And, you know, so you never know what the next book's going to be. You know, you can plan it all you want, but I've never been right in all these years of saying this is going to be my next book. So I'm careful about.
Well, just fall down the stairs gently.
Exactly. Exactly. Make sure there's a pillow at the bottom.
Mark DeWidziak, and it's markdewidziak.com, DAWIDZIAK.com, markdewidziak.com. Mark, a great pleasure. Thanks for taking us down memory lane with Carl Kolchak.
It's fun. This just breezed by. I feel like we're just getting started.
Well, to be continued. Let's talk again sometime.
Yeah, I'd be glad to.
Thanks so much. Okay, before I dim the lights in my little studio beneath the stairs, I'll fill you in on what's coming up next on Conspiracy Unlimited. If you're a fan of this podcast or my weekly radio program, The Conspiracy Show, or my YouTube channel, Strange Planet, I hope you'll consider becoming an official donor. A donation of $50 a month places you in the Star Chamber. $20 a month is the whistleblower tier, and a donation of just $10 per month makes you a truth seeker. Star Chamber and Whistleblower members can participate in an exclusive monthly online chat or video conference with me. And all donors are entered into a monthly draw for Strange Planet merchandise. Any monthly amount is welcome and greatly appreciated. To become an official donor, go to patreon.com/strangeplanet. patreon.com/strangeplanet. Next time on Conspiracy Unlimited, the host of Euphemet, a podcast about one man's adventures with the paranormal.
So the first thing I did when I went to New Orleans to interview this vampire was I actually picked up some protective items from a witchcraft shop. At that time, I was tired, I was puzzled, I was weak from 3.5 weeks of travel at that point, all in one shot. And in other words, I was left wide open when dealing with energies, if that's a thing.
Until then, I'm Richard Serrett. So long for now.
A new Conspiracy Unlimited with Richard Serrett drops every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. Blow your mind. That is all for now. Oh, and remember to share and give a 5-star review, because we have huge egos and need love. We're like cats. We need... we mean constant petting.